This is the NBC Theater. From the NBC Theater in Hollywood, an hour-length dramatic presentation of E.M. Forster's great novel, Howard's End. The adaptation for radio is by Horton Heath. And at intermission, we will bring you a commentary on the writings of E.M. Forster by the nationally known author and radio personality, John Kieran. Mr. Kieran's commentary was transcribed in New York earlier this week. Here now, the NBC Theater version of Howard's End.
Month, the city of London reaches out into the countryside. The roads smell more strongly of petrol, and human beings breathe less of the air, see less of the sky. The cult of the earth is no longer fashionable. To be modern, one looks to the city for inspiration. Certainly, London fascinates. It is intelligent, without purpose, and excitable without love. It is a heart that beats, but with no pulsation of humanity. London only stimulates. It cannot sustain. Nonetheless, Helen and I still lived in London, in Wickham Place, which has been our family home almost since Father came from Germany. Our family name, by the way, is Schlegel. Now, at the time of which I speak, Father and Mother had been gone for some years, and Helen and I lived alone, though rarely without the company of our friends. On the night that this begins, we had company, though not, I hasten to say, a friend. Let me see. Helen was standing by the window, and she turned to me and said,
"Margaret, there's the strangest-looking woman coming up the walk."
"What kind of a strange-looking woman?"
"Well, I don't know. Just look at her. Her clothes. She's all strings and bell pulls and ribbons and chains and bead necklaces. My! And a bow of blue feathers hung around her neck."
"What can she be coming here for?"
"Well, I fancy we'll find out in a moment."
And we did find out. When Mrs. Leonard Best was shown into the living room, it became apparent that her perfume matched her clothes, as did her voice.
"I'm looking for my husband, whom I have reason to believe is in this house."
"Your husband?"
"Yes, miss, my husband."
"His name, please?"
"Len, miss."
"Len? Len what?"
"Len, for Leonard. Leonard Bass, his name. He walked out of the house yesterday afternoon and hasn't been back since. He was gone all night and, well, I figured this would be a likely place to find him."
"Do tell me how in the world you figured that."
"I know what I know."
"Well, tell us what you know. We can't help you find him unless we know, too."
"Well, this was the address on a certain card he had."
"What card?"
"Never mind what card."
"Mrs. Best, I believe that is your name. I am completely mystified. I can assure you your husband is not in this house. I advise you to go to the police."
"Well, thank you, miss, just the same. Len is a naughty, naughty man."
"I'm afraid you may be right."
"He had no business to go on the la-di-da."
Next day, the mystery was explained. The mysterious Leonard Best himself came to the door. Helen and I rushed downstairs. We couldn't wait to see this gay dog of a missing husband. But we were disappointed. He was a mild, colorless young man in his early 20s, with mournful eyes above a drooping moustache.
"You don't remember me, miss. You wouldn't remember giving me this card."
"Why, it's my own card. Where did we meet, Mr. Best? For the moment, I don't remember."
"Well, it was at a concert at the Queen's Hall 2 years ago. I think you will recollect when I tell you that it included a performance of the Fifth Symphony of Beethoven."
"Oh, dear me, they play the Fifth so often. Do you remember, Helen?"
Was it the time the cat walked across the stage?
Oh, I think not, miss.
Oh, then I don't remember. That's the only Beethoven I recollect especially.
Well, on that occasion, if I may say so, you took away my umbrella. Inadvertently, of course.
Oh, that's quite likely. I steal umbrellas oftener than I hear Beethoven. Did you get it back?
Yes, thank you, Miss Schlegel. It was on that occasion your sister gave me this card with her address. This card was the reason for my wife's mistake yesterday.
Because it had a lady's name on it, you mean?
Yes, miss. I said to Mrs. Best, I have to pay a call on some friends. And Mrs. Best said to me, do go. While I was gone, however, she wanted me on important business, and finding Miss Schlegel's card, thought I'd come here. And I beg to tender my apologies, and hers as well, for any inconvenience we may have inadvertently caused you.
Oh, no inconvenience. And naturally it's no concern of ours where you went calling, or for how long.
Oh, I was somewhere else to what you think. I walked all night.
All night?
I wanted to get back to the earth, like Richard does in The Ordeal of Richard Feverel. Oh, it's a beautiful book. Oh, have you ever read Prince Otto by Stevenson?
It's another beautiful book. But tell us about your walk. How far? Where did you start from?
Well, I took the underground at Wimbledon. Oh, it was gas lamps for hours. Still, I had all night, and being out was the great thing. I did get into woods, too, presently. You've no idea how difficult it is to walk on uneven ground in the dark.
You went off the road?
Oh, yes. I wanted to get away from roads. Yeah, but it's difficult to find one's way. I managed one wood and found a road on the other side, which went a good bit uphill. Then I got into another wood. Finally, it got light. I found a station and took the first train I could back to London.
But was the dawn wonderful?
Well, no. The dawn was only grey. Nothing to mention. I was too tired to lift up my head, and cold and hungry, too. It wasn't what you call enjoyment. It was more a case of sticking to it. I was determined. Oh, hang it all. What's the good of living in a room forever? You ought to see once in a while what's going on outside, even if it's nothing particular.
Of course you ought.
Curious it should all come about from reading Thoreau.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Bass, but you're wrong there. It came from something far greater than any book. You are a born adventurer.
Oh, then you don't think I was foolish?
Heavens, no.
No, it wasn't foolish. You've pushed back the boundaries. It was splendid of you.
Well, I'm very glad you say that. Oh, my wife would never understand. Not if I explained for days.
I was quite sure that Mrs. Best wouldn't understand. Not even if Leonard explained for years. And I couldn't help trying to imagine his efforts to convey something of his sentiments to that pathetic creature.
Len, dear, I do think you might explain a bit. I mean, reading all the time like you do.
Never you mind. It's nothing you need be concerned about.
But you do love me, Len, don't you?
Oh, of course I do. I'll tell you one thing. I care a good deal about improving myself by means of literature and art. For instance, just now I was reading Ruskin's Stones of Venice. I also enjoy classical concerts. Now, I don't say this to boast, but just to show you the kind of man I am.
Well, that's all right with me, Len, but you do love me, don't you?
Oh, now, I've told you so again and again. Now, get off my knee a bit. Someone must get supper, I suppose.
I suppose that all would have been well if Helen and I hadn't undertaken to interest ourselves in the problem of Mr. Best and to discuss him with Mr. Wilcox. Oh, you haven't met Henry Wilcox yet. Well, he was, most importantly, the husband of Ruth Wilcox, an older woman we had known and loved for several years before her death. So Henry Wilcox was, What? A widower and a very wealthy businessman. And Helen and I undertook, foolishly perhaps, to talk to him of Leonard Best.
Would it be really kind or helpful, Mr. Wilcox, for some millionaire to give the Best lots of money so they wouldn't have to worry any more? We're so afraid that circumstances would be too strong for the man and he will sink. As a successful man of business, what do you think?
What's his profession?
He's a clerk in some office.
What office, do you know?
Yes, he gave me his business card. The Porphyrion Insurance Company.
Porphyrion, huh? Mm-hmm. Then I can make a very practical suggestion. Let your young friend clear out of the Porphyrion Insurance Company with all possible speed.
Clear out?
This is between friends. Oh. It'll be in the receiver's hands before Christmas. It's going to smash.
Oh, dear me, Meg. Mr. Bass will have to get another place.
We'll have to. Let him leave the ship before it sinks. Let him find another place at once.
Then you really advise us...
I advise nothing. But I happen to know, being more or less behind the scenes, the Porphyrion's in a very bad way.
Mr. Best, we were told the Porphyrion's no go. We wanted to tell you. That's why we asked you for tea.
A friend of ours says that it is insufficiently reinsured.
Well, you can tell your friend that he's quite wrong.
Oh, good.
I wouldn't say he's right altogether.
Well, our friend was so positive. He said that before
Christmas... He advised that you should clear out of it right away.
Oh, now, what do you want to unsettle me for? I was quite happy. Look here. I don't want your patronage. And I don't want your tea.
Poor dear Mr. Best. He wanted to talk literature, and we would talk business. Such a muddle of a man, and yet so worth pulling through.
Miss Schlegel, you behave much too well to people, and then they impose on you. You must keep that type at a distance. They aren't our sort, and, well, one must face the fact.
Oh, but we like him. He cares for physical adventure, just as you do. You go motoring and shooting, and he would like to go camping. Hmm.
He cares for something special in adventure. One could call it poetry.
You know nothing about him. We practical fellows are more tolerant than you young lady intellectuals. We live and let live. We assume that the ordinary plain man may be trusted to look after his own affairs.
Mr. Best isn't a type, as you call him. His brain is filled with the husks of books. Culture. But there's manhood in him as well. That's what I'm trying to say. He's a real man.
You are a pair of dear creatures, but you really must be careful in this uncharitable world.
Then came the second happening of that year, which so materially changed our lives. We were notified by our landlord that we would have to give up Wickham Place, that he proposed to build flats on the site.
Dreadful man, to tear this down to build flats. Where on earth will we live?
Oh, I lie awake at night wondering where all our belongings could possibly fit.
We should revert to the days when people owned land instead of movables. There was dignity in that.
We're becoming a civilization of luggage.
Nothing but a nomadic horde, really.
Yes, and where will we migrate to in September?
Margaret? I've heard Henry Wilcox speak of giving up his place in Ducie Street. I wonder if we might let that.
Possible, I suppose. Helen, wouldn't it be wonderful if instead of Ducie Street it were
Howards End?
Yes, Howards End. Oh, I would love that.
I wonder if anyone's lived there since Ruth Wilcox died.
Oh, Henry doesn't go there much. At any rate, I suppose we should inquire about Ducie Street. The problem's becoming something more than academic.
Please feel free to ask questions about any of the rooms, Margaret. I know how you young women are about houses.
It's awfully kind of you. I'm afraid the house hasn't been built that suits the Schlegel family.
What? Have you come up determined not to make a deal?
Oh, hardly. My, it is indeed a large place.
Yes, and I'm alone in it a great deal of the time now. My son Charles spends most of his time away, of course.
You must have many other friends.
I can tell you it's not fun being left alone so much. I've got my work all day, but when I come home, I can't stand the empty house.
Well, in my absurd way, I'm lonely, too. It's heartbreaking to leave the home where one grew up. But Ducie Street is an excellent location.
I'm glad you don't despise material advantages, Margaret.
Oh, heavens, no. Only idiots and prigs do that.
I am glad, very glad. I can't stand people who run down the comforts of life. Here, you haven't seen this room yet. This is the library. Don't you like these maroon leather chairs?
Oh, jolly.
It's all rubbish not making oneself comfortable. I'm glad you agree.
Yes, of course. The other day, when we were talking, Helen and I wondered about Howards End.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Well, the days for small farms are over. Small holdings, back to the land, philanthropic hokum. 50 years ago, it had six times the land, 30 acres at least. One could have made something of it then. My first, Ruth was deeply attached to it for some reason of her own. Well, now, about this place, Margaret.
Yes, about this place. What is the size of this room?
20 by 15. Wait a minute. 15 and a half.
Mr. Wilcox, aren't you amused at how solemn one has to be about leasing a house?
Miss Schlegel, I have a confession to make.
Oh?
I got you to come here today on false pretenses. I want to speak to you about a much more serious matter than a house. That is, I wanted to ask you, could you be induced to share this house? Could I persuade you...
Oh, my dear Mr. Wilcox.
Miss Schlegel, Margaret, perhaps you don't understand. I'm asking you to be my wife.
It's just like a widower. They invariably select one of their first wives' friends. Meg, you're not seriously considering. Meg, look at me.
Now, really, Helen...
Oh, Meg, don't do such a thing. Don't.
But, Helen, we would still see each other very
often.
Oh,
that's not what I mean at all. That prosperous vulgarian. Meg, do you love him?
Well, it is wonderful knowing that a real man cares for you. Remember, I've known and liked him steadily for nearly 3 years.
But loved him?
No.
But you think you will?
Yes, I'm pretty sure. Indeed, I began the moment he spoke to me. What is it you have against him, Helen?
Oh, it's just that love is the important thing forever and ever.
My kind of lovemaking isn't like yours. It isn't romance, it's realism. For instance, I know all Mr. Wilcox's faults. He's afraid of emotion. He cares too much about success and too little about the past. But I don't intend to let him be all my life.
Oh, Meg, you make it sound worse and worse.
I do mean to marry him, Helen.
I was thinking, Margaret, if you don't mind, that we ought to spend this evening in business talk. There are a number of things to settle.
I think so, too. You haven't had a talk with Helen yet, I suppose?
No.
Do, before you go. I'm so anxious that you two should be friends.
Oh, your sister and I have always hit it off. Now, let me begin at the beginning. My daughter Evie is engaged to be married. Her fiancé is a very good sort of fellow, but he demands, and rightly, a suitable provision with her. In the second place, there's my son Charles. He and Dolly have an increasing family and increasing expenses.
Oh, poor fellow.
Being the elder son, someday Charles will have Howards End, but I wish not to be unjust to anyone.
Oh, you're talking about money. How stupid I am.
Yes, money, since you put it so frankly. I'm determined to be just to all, just to you, and just to them.
Be generous to them. Father Justice, how much have you got?
What?
How much have you a year? I've a clear £600 of my own.
My income?
Yes. We must begin with how much you have before we can settle on how much you can give Charles.
I must say you're a forthright young woman. What a question to spring out a fellow.
Don't you know your income? Perhaps you don't want to tell me. Well, that's all right. Don't tell me. I don't want to know. Let's do it by proportion. Now, divide your income into 10 parts. How many parts do you want to give to Evie? How many to Charles? How many to...
My dear, I had no intention of bothering you with the details. I only wanted to let you know that something must be done for the others.
Of course. Go ahead. Give them all you can. Bearing in mind that I already have a clear 600.
We've none too much, I assure you. You're marrying a poor man.
We discussed a possible date for our wedding, where we might like to live. And all the time we kept away from anything personal. We walked through the pleasant evening toward our house in Wickham Place. And as we started up the path through the garden where it was dark, suddenly and unexpectedly, Henry took me in his arms.
Margaret.
Oh, my dear. He kissed me. My lover kissed me for the first time. And then, without another word, he left me and hurried off to his hotel.
From Hollywood, the NBC Theater is bringing you a dramatization of Howard's End by E.M. Forster. If you're interested in supplementing your enjoyment of these NBC Theater productions with home study under college supervision, be sure to listen to the announcement at the close of this program. And now, our intermission commentator, John Kieran.
I think it adds flavor to a story to know something of the author. E.M. Forster, English novelist, essayist, and critic, is a writer of the old school, and in a way, Howard's End is an old story. It was published in 1910, and the author had been working on it for 2 years. Though he celebrated his 70th birthday last year and is one of the deans of the English literary set, E.M. Forster is by no means an old fogey. And though his own prose is restrained, he is for unrestrained freedom of expression by others. The realist school, if you want to call it that. And he has been a leader in the fight against literary censorship of any kind. His own novels deal largely with class distinctions among the English, the problems they present and the clashes they provoke. Howard's End is one of his best efforts in that direction. Class distinction is by no means entirely a matter of money. Occupation, social position, and family background must be considered. But there's no blinking the fact that, for the most part, and in the long run, family income is the basic difference between the lower and the upper classes. The poor man simply can't afford to be a cultured gentleman. The difference between a vulgarian and a stuffed shirt is that the vulgarian wouldn't feel comfortable in such a shirt and couldn't pay for the stuffing. What we call society somehow recognizes a difference between a good woman and a perfect lady. For social purposes, a man might better have the smallpox than a Cockney accent in England. I don't have an Oxford accent myself. For that matter, neither does E.M. Forster. He went to Cambridge. Of course, these social distinctions are not only superficial, but subject to change without warning. Underneath, we are all human beings endowed with more or less intelligence and the same fundamental desires and emotions. We hunger, we thirst, we love, we hate, we are kind, we are cruel, regardless of any difference in our incomes or positions in society. So in Howard's End, written with artistry, sprinkled with Attic salt, and etched with acid in some parts, we have the inevitable clash between the fundamental and the superficial things in life. The meeting of the trivial with the tragic, the fight between honesty and affectation. It seems to me that in this clash, E.M. Forster tries to give all his contestants fair play. Perhaps that's because he's a real gentleman himself and a writer of the old school.
Thank you, Mr. Kieran. Our radio version of Howard's End will continue from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
It's a flaw inherent in the business mind that it lacks the clearness of vision that is imperative for truth. It cares about things in proportion to their usefulness and therefore arranges them in the following order. Money, supremely useful. Intellect, rather useful. Imagination, of no use at all. It is thrilled by bigness. 1,000 square miles are 1,000 times more wonderful than 1 square mile. And 1,000,000 square miles are almost the same as heaven. And yet, it is the business mind, with its virtues of neatness, decision, and obedience, which has formed our civilization. Has one a right to draw an income and sneer at those who guarantee it? Henry, Helen has had a letter from Leonard Best. Do you remember him, our friend, the office clerk? Well, thanks to your hint, he's clearing out of the Porphyrion Insurance Company.
The Porphyrion? Mm-hmm. Oh, they're in good shape again.
In good shape?
Why, yes. What's the matter?
Why, Henry, don't you remember? You told us they were in bad shape. And so we advised this clerk to clear out. He writes that he's taken our advice.
A clerk that clears out of any concern, good or bad, without securing a berth somewhere else first is a fool, and I can't feel sorry for him.
Oh, he hasn't done that. He's going into a bank. The salary is lower, but he hopes to manage a branch of Dempster's bank. Is that all right?
Dempster? Oh, my goodness, yes, a fine bank.
Mr. Wilcox, I think you told us the Porphyrion Company was going to smash before Christmas.
Did I? Oh, well, they were in a very bad way, but they've got everything straightened out now. They're out of danger.
In other words, Mr. Bass need never have left them.
No, the fellow needn't have.
And needn't have started life elsewhere at a greatly reduced salary.
His letter only says reduced, not greatly reduced.
When a man is so poor, any reduction is great, a great misfortune.
See here, are you implying that I'm responsible?
Helen, that's ridiculous.
All I know is a man who had very little money now has less, owing to us.
Oh, your clerk is my sympathy, but it's all in the day's work. It's part of the battle of life. You're not to blame. Nobody's to blame.
For the next few months, I was much too busy to think about poor Leonard Best. In August, Henry and I attended a wedding in Shropshire, a long way from London. The bride and groom and most of the guests had driven off when an extraordinary thing occurred.
I was standing alone on the lawn in front of the house when 3 people hurried toward me. 3 new and unexpected visitors. In front was my sister Helen.
Helen, what is it? What's wrong?
They're starving. I found them starving.
Who? Why have you come here?
The best. He's lost his place. He's been turned out of his bank. We've ruined him. And I suppose you'll tell me it's the battle of life. Starving. His wife is ill. She fainted on the train.
Helen, are you mad? Have you actually brought 2 starving people from London to Shropshire?
I really didn't want to come.
Yes, I'm mad. But I've brought them and I'll stand in justice no longer.
Don't be absurd. They aren't starving and you know it. I won't have such theatrical nonsense. How do you do, Mr. Best?
Here is Mrs. Best, too.
How do you do, Mrs. Best?
Oh, I don't feel good. I've been sick, but this lady said we must come with her, and, well, here we are. I fainted on the train, but, well, I think I'm feeling better.
I'm sure I don't want to intrude.
After he'd been in the bank a month, they reduced their staff and let him out, and now he's penniless. I consider that we and Mr. Wilcox are directly to blame.
Oh, I hate all this.
I hope you do, Mr. Best.
If you intend to confront Mr. Wilcox and, well, call him to account for a chance remark, you will make a very great mistake.
I brought them. I did it all.
My sister has put you in a false position. I can only advise you to go at once. It's too late to get back to London tonight, but, well, you'll find a comfortable hotel in the village and you'll be my guest there.
Well, that isn't what I want, Miss Schlegel.
It's work he wants, can't you see?
Jackie, come on, let's go. We're more bothered than we're worth. There's nothing we're good enough to do.
I'll speak to Mr. Wilcox and, well, undertake to do what I can for you. Helen, get them something to eat. Do have a sandwich. A glass of champagne.
No, no, thank you. I don't want anything.
I think perhaps I could manage with a little of the champagne. Well,
just stand by right here. I'll get you both something. Fortunately, most of the guests have gone.
Very nice of you to give us a bubbly. I'm sure.
Helen, you shouldn't have let her drink so much.
I thought if we waited, you might have something better to offer. Or Henry might.
As I've tried to explain, it's not up to Henry. I'm sorry about your job, Mr. Best, but I'm sure you'll find something else.
Oh, not I. If rich people fail in one profession, they can try another. But I... Well, I had my groove. I could do one particular branch of service, an insurance company, in one particular office, well enough to command a salary, but that's all. If a man like me once loses his own particular job, well, it's all over with him.
Oh, Margaret, here comes Henry.
Oh, dear, I'd hope to avoid this.
Well, well, if it isn't Henry.
I thought all the guests had gone. A pleasure to find... what's this?
This is Mrs. Best, Henry.
Is it indeed? With a champagne glass in her hand?
She's overtired.
She's something else. This won't do. We can't have her in the garden in this state. Madam, I believe you'll be much more comfortable at the hotel.
Well, if it isn't Hen.
Don't think, Henry, that the husband's anything like the wife. He's very different.
Henry!
I can't congratulate you on your protégés.
Hen, don't go. Where have you been hiding, Hen? Forgotten how to get your little rendezvous, eh?
Heavens, what a repellent person.
You're a nice boy, Hen. Oh, there now. I love you.
Henry, I'm awfully sorry.
And pray why?
To have brought this down on you.
Please, don't apologize.
Jackie, what have you been saying? You've never seen this man before in your whole life.
Seen Hen before? Who hasn't seen Hen? These boys. Just you wait.
There, are you satisfied?
I don't know what this is all about.
Don't you indeed? I do. Allow me to congratulate you on the success of your plan. Very well thought out. I am amused at your caution, Margaret. Yes, I admit. I am a man and have lived a man's past. I have the honor to release you from your engagement.
That woman has been your mistress.
You put it with your usual delicacy.
When, please?
Why do you ask?
When, please?
Oh, all right. 10 years ago.
That evening, I wrote two notes. One was to Leonard Best at the hotel to say that Henry would be unable to help him. The other was to Henry himself. Although it was hours since we'd found Mrs. Best on the lawn, I still could not command my voice to speak to him. So I wrote. This is not to part us. It happened long before we ever met. I mean it to be nothing. I had no illusions about Henry. To have no illusions and yet to love. What stronger surety can a woman find? A month later, Henry and I were married quietly. Helen did not come to our wedding. Henry. Henry, I'm becoming quite provoked with Helen. She's just being obstinate, you know.
Still no letter from her?
Oh, just another one of her vague postcards. She's been abroad 4 months now, ever since that dreadful night in Shropshire.
And no satisfactory reason for not wanting to come home?
Oh, none whatsoever. She simply says her plans are uncertain and had better be ignored.
Len, a letter came from your brother. I opened it. I knew you wouldn't mind.
Did he send the money order?
Yes, he did. £2 was all it was, though.
Yeah, let me see the letter.
You won't like what he had to say, Len.
Oh, I can guess what he says. Surprising, isn't it, that I can't find work after all these months? Can't be trying my very hardest, can I? Better look out or I'll be worse than unemployed. I'll be what they call unemployable.
Oh, I've such good news, Henry. A letter from Helen. She's on her way to London.
Oh, good. I knew she couldn't stay away forever.
Oh, 8 months. It seems like a lifetime. It's rather a strange letter, though. Apparently she's not coming here to the house. She says to write or wire her, care of her bank.
Oh, nonsense. Helen must stop with us. She has no other home. Your old house in Wickham Place has been torn down. Let her come here to Ducie Street.
Her letter says she wishes to get some of her books and personal things out of storage.
Well, she'll have to go to Howards End to find what she wants. All your furniture's been stored there. We will wire the bank at once.
Helen Schlegel acknowledges receipt of your telegram. Kindly inform us time and place she may have access to property in storage at Howards End. We regret we are not authorized to furnish you her present address.
Oh, what can be the matter? All this mystery is rather frightening. Henry, you don't think that Helen can have become, well, in some way a little unbalanced mentally?
That, my dear, is something we must find out. Now listen carefully.
Yes.
I have a plan that will enable us to know when she goes down to Howards End. We'll be able to catch up with her there. They told me at the station a lady had come by the London train and taken a carriage to Howards End. It could be no one but Helen. Stop here, Crane. Here's where we pick up Dr. Mansbridge. Good for you, Doctor. Ready and waiting. This is Mrs. Wilcox.
How do you do?
How do you do, Doctor?
I read your letter, of course, Mr. Wilcox, but now please tell me what medical services you think you're going to require.
Dr. Mansbridge, we have no idea. None, I hope. It's just that my sister's been, well, acting so strangely. We thought, Mr. Wilcox thought...
A precautionary measure, Doctor. Our main object is not to frighten Miss Slagle. The house is my property, so it should seem quite natural for us to be there.
Oh, if only I hadn't lied to her. I wrote her 4 days ago. I told her the things she wanted were at Howards End, and if she came Monday, the caretaker would let her in. Now here I am, spying on her.
My dear Margaret, it is for her own good. Doctor, Miss Schlegel's trouble is evidently nervous. She was always highly strung. Musical, literary, artistic, a very charming girl, but high strung.
Well, we shall soon find out. That must be her carriage in the driveway.
There she is, sitting on the porch. She doesn't see us. Stop here, Crane. Let me run ahead. Hello, Helen.
Meg.
Oh, my darling.
Why are you here?
Oh, my darling, forgive me.
Is our runaway girl all right?
Yes. Yes, all right. Quick, Helen, go into the house.
Why, Margaret, you look upset. What have you done with Helen?
Henry, go away. I will take care of her.
But we shall need your help, Mrs. Wilcox. Can you persuade your sister to come out?
Doctor, I wish you and my husband to leave me here now. If your services are required, I will let you know.
Mrs. Wilcox, whether intentionally or not, I do not know, but you did not give me all the facts. I was observing Miss Schlegel when she ran into the house. It's quite obvious that... Well, I see no point in beating around the bush. Your sister's time must be getting rather short.
What do you mean, Doctor?
I'm referring to the fact that Mrs. Wilcox's sister is pregnant.
Go away, both of you.
Doctor, are you sure? This is a shocking business. Margaret, it's doctor's orders. Open the door.
Forgive me, but I will not. Doctor, she doesn't need you. Her confinement is weeks away.
Now, Margaret, you must be calm.
Don't you see? Affection is all she needs now. You would trouble my sister for no reason. I will not permit it. Not if I have to stand in front of this door all day. Why didn't you tell me, darling?
Oh, I might have, but I decided to wait. Of course, Meg, this is a shock to you, but... Well, I've had plenty of time to think it over and make plans. I've taken a flat in Munich. Tell me, how is it that this house is furnished with our furniture? All our books on the shelves.
Oh, a series of mistakes. We didn't intend to furnish the house. Just to store things here.
Who lives here?
No one. This house is dead. Why worry about it?
Well, I'm interested. You talk as if I'd lost all interest in life. This doesn't feel like a dead house. These rooms seem very much alive.
Helen, you shouldn't have stayed away. You shouldn't have let me go on not knowing. Why did you? Is it all because you hate Henry?
Oh, I don't hate Henry anymore. I've stopped being a schoolgirl. Meg, I don't mean to be unkind. But as for fitting my new life in with yours, you might as well put it out of your head at once. I've done something the English never forgive. Oh, Meg, are you sure this is Howard's End? Mr. Wilcox's house?
Yes, it is. As you know, he hasn't lived in it since Ruth died.
But it doesn't seem like his house. It seems like ours. Who was it hung Father's old German sword across the books?
Oh, it was all an idea of the old caretaker. She unpacked everything. She's a village character who loved Ruth Wilcox. Would rather furnish her house with our things and think of it empty.
Come on, let's look at the upstairs. I have a startling idea.
What is it?
Prepare yourself for a shock. Mm. Let's you and I camp out here in the house tonight.
Oh, I'm afraid we couldn't do that.
Well, why not? Here are beds and linen and towels. Oh, I'd love to have one night here with you. Tomorrow I leave for Munich. It'll be something to look back on.
Oh, you darling. I'll ask Henry if he would mind, and I'm afraid I'll have to explain to him.
My dear girl, this is a troublesome business. Was your sister wearing a wedding ring?
No. Henry, I've come back here to the hotel to ask a favor.
One thing at a time. I am now obliged to ask for the name of her seducer.
Seducer? Why, I don't know his name.
Wouldn't she tell you?
I never even asked her.
That's rather surprising. Until his name is known, we can't do anything.
We?
Charles and I. My son. I thought it best to telephone him to come.
That was unnecessary.
Do you think that I and my son are not gentlemen? It is still not too late to save Helen's good name.
Are we to make her seducer marry her?
If possible, yes. Or he must pay heavily for his misconduct and be thrashed within an inch of his life.
Henry, Tomorrow, Helen goes to Munich.
Well, that's probably a good idea.
Tomorrow she goes. Tonight, with your permission, she would like to sleep at Howard's End.
Howard's End? Oh, come now. She'll be much more comfortable at the hotel.
It is an odd request, Henry, but you know Helen. You know what women in her condition are. She finds it soothing to be in the house with all our books and furniture.
If she wants to sleep one night, she may want to sleep two. Perhaps she shall never get her out of the house.
No, Henry. We will trouble Howard's End for only this one night. I will take her to London tomorrow.
Do you intend to sleep there, too?
Well, she cannot be left alone.
Oh, that's quite impossible. You must be here to talk to Charles when he arrives.
Oh, what has all this got to do with Charles? It's no business of his.
As the future owner of Howard's End, I should say it does concern Charles.
In what way? Will Helen's condition depreciate the property?
My dear, you are forgetting yourself. Helen commands my sympathy, but I cannot treat her as if nothing had happened. I should be forced to my position in society if I did.
Henry, tomorrow she will go to Germany and trouble society no longer. Tonight she asked to sleep in your empty house, a house you do not care about. Will you give my sister permission? Will you forgive her, as you yourself have been forgiven? Forgive her for one night only. That will be enough.
I'm afraid your sister had better sleep at the hotel. I have my children and the memory of their dear mother to consider. I'm sorry, but see that she leaves my house at once.
You mentioned Mrs. Wilcox, your wife. In reply, may I mention Mrs. Best?
Margaret, you have not been yourself all day.
You shall see the connection, Henry, if it kills you. You had a mistress. I forgave you. Helen had a lover. You drive her out of the house. Contemptible, hypocritical, cruel. A man who insults his wife when she's alive and then piously invokes her memory when she's dead. A man who ruins a woman for his pleasure and then casts her off to ruin other men. And gives bad financial advice. And then says that he is not responsible. It's you I'm talking about, Henry. All your life you've been spoiled. Ruth spoiled you. I've spoiled you. No one has ever told you what you are. Muddled. Criminally muddled. Only say to yourself, what Helen has done, I have done. I returned to Howard's End without Henry's permission. I did not tell Helen about my talk with him. This was to be her evening. I didn't want to spoil it by discussing the price I was prepared to pay. The night was warm. We spent the evening talking in the garden. And then, for the first time, she named the father of her child. Perhaps I should have known.
That night last August, in the hotel in Shropshire, when your letter was brought in, telling Anna that Mr. Wilcox had no work for him, I was overcome by pity, by a desire for revenge. I wanted to go to you for an explanation, but Leonard said no. It was something to do with his wife. He didn't want you to know about it.
But I did know.
I could guess that Mr. Wilcox had ruined him in two ways, not just one.
Oh, poor Mr. Best.
I was to blame, not he. He would have gone on worshipping me.
He doesn't know.
Well, he's no reason to know I'm expecting a child. Or that I'm in England either.
Oh, my poor Helen.
No, not poor Helen. Poor Leonard Best. I tried to send him money through my bank, quite a large sum. With a message that he was in no need of money. I hope he was telling the truth.
I always said he was a real man.
Yes, but now... Oh, Meg, it sounds appalling. I don't want ever to see him again.
But Helen was to see Leonard Best again. On the morning after Helen and I had camped in the house overnight, Charles Wilcox arrived early that morning, spoilt and righteous boy that he was.
My father feels that a very basic question is involved, the rights of property itself. He asked me to tell you that he will do what he can for your sister, with the understanding that she leaves this house immediately.
Yes, I see, Charles. Will you be good enough, then, to tell your father, with my love, that I am leaving for Germany with my sister today?
Well, if you say so, but I don't know how Father will take to that.
I don't think it matters.
I heard someone come in the front. Oh!
Your housekeeper in London told me I'd find you here.
Be quiet!
Mrs. Wilcox, I had to tell you. I've done wrong.
Leonard Best!
No, I've got to speak about it. It's been driving me out of my mind ever since...
Leonard Best! You're the fellow I'm looking for. I'm sure of it.
Mrs. Wilcox, what I did was...
Best, I'm going to thrash you within an inch of your life. A stick. Where's a stick?
Charles, you fool!
Here, now, this will do.
Put down that sword!
Here, what do you think you're... Here, keep off me!
Don't think you can get away!
Oh! Watch out! Monkey!
Keep off me!
I just hit him with the flat of the sword.
Be quiet. Let me look at him.
He pulled the books over on top of himself.
Oh, Meg. Get the doctor.
I'm afraid it's too late for the doctor.
There's no need to trouble about the fellow, Peter. He was in the last stages of heart disease. All I did was to take him by the coat collar and hit him once or twice over the shoulders with an old sword. Well, he caught hold of the bookcase, came down on top of him with all the books. We all thought he was shamming. However, he was dead, right enough.
You struck him with a sword? What sword?
Well, it's an old sword hanging on the bookcase. It was the first thing handy. I had no riding whip or stick.
But the real cause was heart disease. You're sure of that?
Yeah, well, that or a fit. It'll be brought out tomorrow at the inquest.
Naturally. Meanwhile, I think I'll go around and talk with the police. Margaret, I have something to tell you.
I don't want to hear it. My life is going to be with my sister now. We must manage to build up something. She and I and her child.
Where are you going?
Munich. We shall start directly after the inquest.
After the inquest? Have you thought about what the verdict of the inquest will be?
Yes, heart disease.
No, my dear. Charles will be charged with manslaughter.
Manslaughter?
I've been to the police. He may go to prison. I have dared to tell him. I don't know what to do. Everything I've worked for all my life, it's broken up. It's ended. I'm through.
Henry, what will they do to Charles?
It seems certain there'll be a prison sentence, a minimum of 3 years at hard labor. Oh, Margaret, he can't face it. He can't face it.
What do you want me to do?
I need you, Margaret. Do with me what you can, but... don't leave me now.
Oh, Henry, I shan't leave you. Not as long as I'm needed. We'll stay. You and Helen and I at Howard's End. The court handed down its verdict. Charles Wilcox guilty of manslaughter and sentenced to 3 years hard labor. After that, Henry's defenses were broken down. He was a beaten man. We stayed, as I had proposed, at Howard's End. And there Helen's son was born. And there Helen learned to laugh again. The meadow was recut. The great red poppies reopened in the garden. The seasons changed. A measure of peace came to all of us.
You did it all, Meg, darling. Henry needed you. I needed you. Everyone said it wouldn't work.
Helen is right. You picked up the pieces and made us a home.
I did only the obvious thing. You and Henry learned to understand one another. But I agree. This is our home.
It is yours, Margaret. I've made a new will and left Howards End to you absolutely.
Henry, one of the reasons I've come to like you is because you worry about wills and things like that.
And I like you, Helen, because you never worry about anything.
How both of you have improved. Henry, I want you to know that I, in turn, shall bequeath Howards End to my nephew, who was born here. Helen's son.
Of course, my dear. You know about this place, there's something that perhaps I should have told you before. My first... Ruth wanted you to have Howards End.
Ruth wanted me to have it? Well, how do you mean? Why?
It belonged to her, you know, and I think she knew how you'd feel about it. When she was ill, not being herself at the time, she scribbled your name and Howards End on a piece of paper. As it is clearly fanciful, I set it aside, and I didn't bring it up at the reading of the will, little knowing what my Margaret would be to me in the future. I didn't do wrong, did I?
Oh, you didn't, darling. Nothing has been done wrong. I would not want anything changed.
You have been listening to Howards End, an NBC theater production of the novel by E.M. Forster. If you wish to increase your knowledge and appreciation of literature, we suggest that you might enjoy the college-supervised courses now being offered in connection with the NBC Theater. For full information, write to NBC Theater in care of one of the following universities or colleges: the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky, the University of Tulsa, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas, Washington State College, Pullman, Washington, the University of Arizona, Tucson, Arizona, Texas College of Arts and Industries, Kingsville, Texas, and Brooklyn College, Brooklyn, New York. You also have a chance to win a set of the famous Encyclopedia Britannica. Several of the universities and colleges offering these courses are giving the Encyclopedia as prizes to the students doing the best work. Enroll in a supervised course, and you may be one of the fortunate ones to win the Encyclopedia Britannica. Be with us at the NBC Theater next week for a radio adaptation of Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf, and the following week for a special Easter Day broadcast of The Nazarene by Sholem Ash. Howards End was adapted for the NBC Theater by Horton Heath. Our intermission commentator was John Kieran, whose commentary was recorded. In today's cast, Alma Lawton was Margaret, Eileen Erskine was Helen, Queenie Leonard was Jackie, Terry Kilburn was Leonard, Tom Dillon was Henry, and Ben Wright was Charles. Your announcer, Don Stanley. The director of the NBC Theater is Andrew C. Love. This program came to you from Hollywood. What's on NBC today? Well, today you'll hear the stellar comedy. You'll hear comedy with Danny Kaye, Phil Harris, and Alice Faye, all on NBC. Hear Danny Kaye starring in The Milky Way on Theater Guild on the Air, and the laugh-packed Phil Harris-Alice Faye show. There's great entertainment in store for you today on Theater Guild and the Phil Harris-Alice Faye show. Be sure to listen. You're tuned for the stars on NBC.